This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Another bloody day in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military attacks the Jenin refugee camp, killing several Palestinians. South Korea imposes unilateral sanctions on the North in response to its latest ballistic missile tests. Plus, a new report says US inflation increased in September over a surge in rents and higher costs of food and medical care. Welcome to World News live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, just hours ago, the Israeli military raided a Palestinian refugee camp in the Flashpoint West Bank city of Jenin. We do know that there have been multiple casualties. Let's cross over to Ramallah in the occupied territories, where our correspondent Mona Kandil is there, ready to tell us what exactly is happening on the ground. Mona.
The Israeli forces continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis. Israeli troops stormed Jenin and its refugee camp early on Friday, according to the Israeli military, to conduct arrests among the Palestinians. As usual, Israeli soldiers used their weapons towards the Palestinians. They first killed a Palestinian man from Jenin refugee camp. And then the Palestinian doctors in Jenin hospital were waiting for to receive the Palestinians who were injured during this operation. And unfortunately, Israeli forces continue to open fire even at Palestinian paramedics and the doctors inside the whole of the hospital, killing this Palestinian doctor, Mohammed Aboutin. But some sources are saying that some sources from Jenin saying that the doctor is in serious condition, and up till the moment he didn't pass away. So we can't tell that for sure. Two Palestinians were killed. We have to say that one Palestinian was shot dead, a Palestinian fighter, during the operation. The doctor, up till the moment as we are receiving now, he is still in the intensive care, and he is under surgeries. hoping that he would succeed. His condition is very serious. A third Palestinian was killed also today, actually. A Palestinian from Jenin, Mohammed Turkman, succumbed to his injuries he sustained 1 month ago. He was one of the Palestinians carried out an anti-Israel operation in the Jordan Valley last month, and he was arrested by the Israeli forces. Today, the Israeli authorities revealed that the Palestinian prisoner Mohammed Turkman has succumbed to his injuries he sustained 1 month ago. So, in addition to these to the killings of the Palestinians, the Palestinian paramedics said that at least 8 Palestinians were wounded during this operation to Jenin refugee camp.
Right, Mona. There are reports reaching us that the latest Israeli invasion in Jenin, the heart of the Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank, is ongoing as we speak. But, you know, Israeli, the regime forces, they're not sparing anyone over there in Jenin, as well as all across the occupied Palestinian territories. But specifically in Jenin, you've got the medics being shot dead, journalists being shot dead. Even a 12-year-old boy was killed the other day.
For the Israeli soldiers, all Palestinians are, let's say, enemies during these operations, whether paramedics, whether doctors. There were footage we received for a Palestinian ambulance trying to pull out the Palestinian martyr in one of the narrow streets of Jenin refugee camp. And the Israeli soldiers continued to open their fire at the Palestinian paramedics and ambulance officers, wounding 2 of those Palestinian paramedics. They didn't allow them to pull out the body of the Palestinian man who was killed. Of course, they didn't cause any, let's say, threat on the life of the Israeli soldiers. But it's a policy during these operations that the Israeli forces want to continue their operation, want to pull back from the area they raided safe and sound without leaving any of the Palestinians resisting the Israeli soldiers. So on the one hand, the Israeli forces use their weapons, kill people and injure people, women, children, and now doctors. But at the same time, they don't want for the Palestinians to resist them or face them or force them to leave the refugee camp.
Okay, so there you are. The latest there from Muna on the latest Israeli invasion of the Palestinian Jenin refugee camp, where Israel is trying to wipe the Palestinians off the face of the earth. Now, moving on, Canada has imposed more sanctions against Iran over what it calls human rights violations in that country. The new sanctions target 3 Iranian entities and 17 individuals, including former Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The measures ban dealings with the sanctioned people and entities, among other things. Last week, Canada also imposed sanctions on a number of other Iranian individuals and entities, including Press TV. Ottawa has cited alleged rights violations during the recent protests in Iran. Those protests broke out over the September 16 death of young woman Mahsa Amini, but soon turned into riots. Iran has reacted to previous bans by Canada. It referred to crimes against the indigenous people in Canada, saying Ottawa is in no position to question other countries over human rights. Author and journalist Arnold August believes Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country. They are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
Iran has been hosting a conference on Islamic unity for several days now, and this event could not have happened at a better time when it comes to the issue of Palestine. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has told the conference that Palestine remains at the forefront for Muslims and that the path of resistance needs to be continued to prevail over the Zionist regime.
Iran is hosting the 36th International Conference on Islamic Unity in the capital, Tehran, which hosts 200 Shia and Sunni clerics, as well as thinkers from some 60 different countries. The annual event puts into discussion the challenges faced by the Muslim world. It's widely believed that uniting Muslims in the region and worldwide would be a great step in alleviating the problems they're facing. Violence and wars are killing Muslims in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, proposed the idea in the 1980s to bring Muslims together against the imperialist aggressions and interventions of Western powers. Over the years, Iran has championed the cause of Islamic unity and brotherhood. This is when many other Muslim countries have brazenly become facilitators and enablers of America's neo-imperialism. The highlight of this year's event was a speech by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to the participants of the conference. During his speech, President Raisi hailed resistance as the only viable path to confronting the Israeli regime. Raisi further said that history has proven wrong those countries who assumed that negotiations would save Palestine.
The biggest human rights violators are the US, Israel, and some Western countries, despite their claims to be human rights defenders. See their record, what they have done to their own people and the people around the globe.
Raisi also referred to previous deals reached with the Tel Aviv regime on the issue of Palestine, saying the regime has refused to honor the commitments it has made. He also criticized the Arab governments that normalized their ties with Israel and the Zionist regime. He said the U.S. and the Israeli regime are trying to marginalize Palestinians through normalization deals. Raisi was referring to the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco, which normalized their ties with Israel in late 2020 under deals pushed by former U.S. President Donald Trump.
Well, the Palestinian issue has been one of the most important topics discussed at the conference. The occupation of Palestinian land has been highlighted as the greatest peril facing the Muslim world and the biggest obstacle in the path towards Islamic unity. This year, the Israeli regime is setting records when it comes to the killing of Palestinians. Over 100 fatalities so far. Illegal detentions, destruction of property and other violations have also continued unabated.
One of the issues that was highlighted in this conference was how Muslims in Palestine are brutally oppressed by the Israeli regime, which is supported by the West and some regional Arab states that have betrayed the cause of Palestine. The normalization deals with the Israeli regime has emboldened Tel Aviv to carry out more war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
It's no surprise to us that the House of Saud has teamed up with the Israeli regime. They claim to be Muslims, but in fact they are the puppets of the Israelis and do what Tel Aviv dictates to them.
So far this year, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds amid a massive increase in Israeli military raids. Israel has killed five times as many Palestinians in 2022 than it killed in the same period in 2021.
سياسة إسرائيل هي مصادرة الأراضي وتهويدها واستعمارها وطرد سكانها وتجميعهم في معازل منفصلة عن بعضها البعض سواء هناك انتخابات أو لم يكن هناك انتخابات ولكن في موسم الانتخابات تزيد وتيرة الإجراءات والاعتداءات والمصادرات الإسرائيلية لكي يحصل المرشحين من الحكومة على أصوات أكثر لأن الجو السائد في إسرائيل هو جو متطرفين فبالتالي الحكومة تحاول أن تكسب من هؤلاء مزيد من الأصوات.
And on the issue of Palestinian prisoners, nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. They called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians. Conferences like the one held in Iran helped the Palestinian cause by continuing to point to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. If the Palestinian cause is not the most important issue for Muslims and the wider world, then Israeli forces will continue using excessive force in their dealings with the Palestinians without being held accountable.
Welcome back. North Korea test fires yet another missile as the situation on the Korean Peninsula escalates to new highs. According to a South Korean news agency, Pyongyang launched a short-range ballistic missile into the sea and flew nearly a dozen fighter jets close to the border with the South. The North Korean military has described its latest actions as strong countermeasures to Seoul's provocative artillery fire near the border. It also accuses the South of inciting tensions with its reckless actions. Seoul has reacted angrily to the latest test, urging its northern neighbor to refrain from creating military tensions.
North Korea's artillery fire and short-range ballistic missile launch in the buffer zone of the East and West Sea are serious provocations that undermine peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula as well as the international community. Our military warns North Korea against continuing provocations causing military tensions on the Korean Peninsula and strongly urges it to stop them immediately.
Seoul has also imposed its first unilateral sanctions against the North in nearly 5 years. It has blacklisted North Korean individuals and institutions involved in missile development. Pyongyang has carried out several missile tests over the past 2 weeks that were overseen by the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. The North says its tests are necessary and a response to joint military drills by the South, the United States, and Japan. Pyongyang considers the war games as a rehearsal for invasion. More bad news for the U.S. economy. The official data shows the country's inflation jumped more than expected in September, despite an aggressive central bank policy. According to the Labor Department statistics, prices rose 0.4% in September compared to the previous month. It says the impact was largely felt on food, shelter, and medical care. The report comes before the midterm elections, in which Republicans have sought to blame President Joe Biden's administration for the crisis. It also raises concerns that the Federal Reserve will extend its policy of supersized interest rates to counter inflation. Last month, the Fed increased the rate for the third time to bring down inflation, which peaked at a nearly 40-year high in June. The Treasury Secretary and other officials have defended their economic policies. They attribute price rises to supply chain problems and other unforeseen events, including the war in Ukraine.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The blessed birthday of the best of creation. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on one of the most blessed days of the year. Today is the 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the grand day in the history of mankind, when the Almighty Creator of the universe decided to bring into the world his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us for a special program on this auspicious occasion, before a start of which we present you Ayah 81 of Surah Isra, where God Almighty informs mankind, "And say, the truth has come, and falsehood has vanished. Indeed, falsehood is bound to vanish." We are celebrating the auspicious 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the blessed birthday of the best of creation. His identity is obvious and needs no introduction. His coming was foretold in all previously revealed heavenly scriptures and the tidings given by the prophets of the past. As for the exact date of his birthday, reason says we should refer to family accounts of the birth of God's last and greatest messenger, since narrations from those who had witnessed the events at his birth and passed them down from father to son are most reliable than the hearsay of companions he acquired at the age of 40 years and after, or the wives he had to marry out of social necessity as a 53-year-old widower in the last 10 years of his life. Thus, according to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, his dearest cousin, ward, son-in-law, and divinely designated vicegerent, who was personally groomed by the Prophet almost a decade before he proclaimed his universal mission of Islam, the above-mentioned ayah was clearly heard from a voice emanating from the sky at sunset, while at the Holy Kaaba, the idols installed by the Arabs in and around the supreme edifice of monotheism built by Prophet Abraham in antiquity fell headlong on the ground. Household accounts quote the Prophet's virtuous mother, Amina bint Wahab, peace upon her, who had seen strange signs during pregnancy, that when he was born, an invisible voice echoed in the house, saying, "The best of creation is born. Name him Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny." His Ahlul Bayt, whom God has made immune from any blemish and uncleanness, as verified by Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab of the Noble Quran, further say, "When the newborn was brought to Abdul Muttalib, peace upon him, he took him in his arms and said, 'I praise and thank Allah who blessed me with such a handsome grandson, who surpasses all children.'" The monotheist grandfather then composed a poem praising the newborn's grace. The Prophet's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, has said that on the Prophet's birth, Fatima bint Asad, peace upon her, the mother of Imam Ali, peace upon him, rushed to her husband, Abu Talib, peace upon him, and gave the good news of the birth of a radiant nephew to him. She also described strange things about the wonderful birth. Abu Talib, peace upon him, said, "After 30 years, a son will be born to you too, who will be like this newborn in every aspect except prophethood." The famous Iranian scholar Sheikh Khuleini, who flourished over a millennium ago, has, through reliable chains of authority, related from the same source that at the time of the Prophet's birth, Fatima bint Asad was with Amina bint Wahab, peace upon them, who asked her, "Do you see what I can see?" Fatima bint Asad asked, "What do you see?" Amina replied, "The radiance which is rising and spreading everywhere from the east to the west." In the meantime, Abu Talib, peace upon him, arrived and asked, "What strange things were being discussed?" Fatima bint Asad, peace upon her, spoke about that radiance. Abu Talib, peace upon him, said, "Do you want me to give glad tidings to you also? A son, Imam Ali, will be born to you too, who will be the legatee of this newborn, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny." Another narration says Abu Talib, peace upon him, performed the aqiqah, or hair removing ceremony of his nephew, on the seventh day of his birth, and invited the entire Hashemite family. They asked, "What is the occasion?" He replied, "It is the Walime feast of Aqiqah of Ahmad." The gathering asked, "Why do you call him Ahmad?" He said, "Because those in the heavens praise him as such." Those pseudo-Muslims wrongly accusing the Prophet's guardian and uncle, who till the last years of his life fiercely protected his nephew from the plots of the pagan Arabs, of lacking faith in Islam, should read the Noble Quran, where, in Ayah 6 of Surah Saf, the Almighty Allah has quoted the tidings of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, to his followers, some 6 centuries before the birth of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "O children of Israel, indeed I am the Prophet of Allah to you, to confirm what is before me of the Torah, and to give the tidings of the Prophet to come after me, whose name is Ahmad." It is also interesting to note that the Gospel of Saint John, despite the tampering it has gone through during the past 2 millennia, still preserves Jesus' word of the coming of the last and greatest prophet, using the word Comforter in the English translation and the word Paraclete in the Greek translation, which in turn is the translation of the original Hebrew Aramic word Hamda, or the praiseworthy, and which in Arabic means Ahmad. This is further proof of the universal mission of the Prophet of Islam to all mankind, and the reliability of the narrations of his monotheist household, as is confirmed by Ayah 157 of Surah A'raf of the Noble Quran. "Those who follow the Prophet, the unschooled messenger, whose mention they find written with them in the Torah and the Evangel, who bids them to do what is right and forbids them from what is wrong, makes lawful to them all the good things and forbids them from all vicious things, and relieves them of their burdens and the shackles that were upon them. Those who believe in him, honor him, and help him and follow the light that has been sent down with him, they are the felicitous."
Thank you.
It is outside the scope of this brief radio program to mention the prayers of Prophet Abraham, peace upon him, for Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, or the prophecy of Prophet Moses and Prophet Isaiah about the last prophet, and the predictions in the sacred texts of the Zoroastrians and Hindus about the prevailing over all the world of the universal creed of Islam. In short, since we are celebrating the birth of the best of creation, we should scientifically probe the exemplary life of the best of creation, the legacy he left, for whom, and did those who claim to be the political representative of the Prophet of Peace follow his advice and formula for unity, especially the following hadith. I am leaving behind among you the Thaqalain, two weighty things, the Book of God, Quran, and my progeny, the Ahlul Bayt. Hold fast to them, and you will not go astray, for the two never separate with each other, even when they return to me at the fountain of Kothar on Resurrection Day.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Midstream.
initial approvals of Lebanon and the occupying Israeli entity on the draft agreement on the demarcation of the maritime border between the two sides entered the stage of operational steps. This is a historic deal for both sides. The operational steps will include announcing an official position approving the agreement before embarking on executive steps related to the final drafting of the papers that must be signed by representatives of the two parties with the participation of the United States as a mediator and the United Nations, which then leads to announcing the validity of the agreement. To discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament at the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Moussaoui. Now, we are currently in the eye of the storm of loud statements and contradicting positions concerning the success of the mediated maritime border demarcation negotiations. The highlight of this was a phone call between U.S. President Joe Biden and Lebanese President Michel Aoun and in Beirut, and the Prime Minister of the Israeli entity government in occupied Palestine, with congratulations and supporting for this for the success of this negotiations. In a simple question, who made this success possible?
Well, thank you for giving the opportunity first, and let me say that we are talking here about a combination of factors that came together and boiled down to this very important development in the economical or financial situation of Lebanon, though not in the short term. First and foremost, we have to thank the resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General, and all those who have been very cautious and continues to be cautious as well up till now, for their efforts in order to make this take place. Of course, we can talk about the unified position of the official Lebanese state. I mean, the state in Lebanon, the President Michel Aoun, the Speaker of the House, and the Premier, they all had one unified position, and this is very telling about the unification of the position of Lebanon, whether in this matter or in other matters. So here we are talking about the people, we are talking about the state, we are talking about the resistance. The resistance and the drones that were sent over Karish, they sent the alarming signal to the Israelis that you cannot extract the oil or the gas, you cannot explore or exploit without giving Lebanon the right to do so. So I would say that the reason for this, the cause of this, we should all thank, is the combination of the factors which the resistance occupies the primary seat in it.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, we did hear Secretary General of Hezbollah Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stating after the announcement of the success of the negotiation, he stated, and I quote, "We in the resistance won't say that things are over until the delegation signed the document at Naqoura, that's South Lebanon." Meanwhile, he also warned his enemies that until the Lebanese people see the delegations going to Naqoura on TV, the resistance must remain cautious. Now, this is clearly a vigilant stance by His Eminence that lacks any trust to his enemies, as always. But what is he being watchful of at this specific phase in the negotiations?
Well, you know very well when Sayyid Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, talks, he presides over a long history of experiences with the Israeli enemy. We know this enemy in different instances. I mean, we have seen, we have learned, we have matured, we have the wisdom. And when I say this, I say it in the name of Sayyid Nasrallah, because he is the one who is leading all of this struggle, honorable struggle against the Israelis on all levels and on all fields. That's why what's he cautious, and he wants the Lebanese to be cautious, he wants the resistance fighters to be on high maximum alert, is that the Israelis can flop the whole position, and they can, if you want, stab in the back. This is the nature of the enemy, the hostility and the hostile nature of the enemy. And this is the kind of things that they might do at any time. So because we are wise enough, as Lebanon, as Hezbollah, Sayyid Nasrallah has been telling the Israelis all of the time that you can never take us by surprise. And we are ready, we are vigilant, we are on high alert, and we will always be there for you if you try to do any deceiving for Lebanon.
Well, Dr. Ibrahim, we did see that we had lots of stances in Lebanon as well as in the Israeli entity in the media. We did see Benjamin Netanyahu claiming that this was a historic deal that snubbed the nose of Israel for the first time in comparison to other deals or other agreements made. This is the first time that Netanyahu thinks that Israel has bent down to Lebanon. How do you think this kind of statement will affect the internal Israeli entities community?
Well, this is a very important remark by you. I would say that it's very natural. The kind of expression that was used by Netanyahu about bowing to Hezbollah pressure and surrendering to Hezbollah, and that Israel has signed this agreement with the pistol in its head by Sayyid Nasrallah, we all heard that, but at the same time, the estimations and the assessment of the Israeli intelligence and military and security apparatuses, the three of them, they said this is very necessary to do, and they are responsible for it, not only the premier, the Israeli premier. The other things that we have to be very aware of is that the Israelis have always been exercising their hegemonic and their prejudice and if you want, their despotic nature all over the Arab and the Islamic world. When they come, there are rare times when they bowed down. Of course, they bowed down and they were brought to their knees by Hezbollah in the military confrontation. Now, with this deal, economic deal that has been reached to this kind of agreement, call it whatever you want, they have been brought down to their knees by Hezbollah on the economic level. When Hezbollah warned the Israelis and threatened them that Karish is going to be targeted if they are going to start to explore and exploit and extract the oil or gas and exclude Lebanon from having the right to do so. By this, we say that the Israelis have been brought again into their knees by Hezbollah, by the resistance in Lebanon, by the combination of these factors. But at the same time, the Israelis will not be able in any way to, like, say, surrender or go away from accepting the reality. This is a de facto situation that was imposed on them. Why? Because they cannot but to do it. Even Netanyahu himself, if he was the prime minister, he would have signed the agreement. This has been told to him. This is another surrender, and this is another testimony by the Israelis that they cannot by any way fight Hezbollah or stand to Hezbollah fight. Again, what's the alternative to the Israelis? The alternative would be a complete failure on the military level and on the economic level because they want to invest the oil in the occupied territories.
Well, that is on the Israeli front, but what about the Lebanese front, where a lot of Hezbollah's foes are accusing the resistance of being part of some sort of a normalization, or that Lebanon has given up its rights, especially by giving up the Line 29 in Karish? How do you think such statements would affect the resistance inside of Lebanon?
Sayyid Nasrallah has been very clear yesterday during his speech. We're talking about only a few hours past this time. Sayyid Nasrallah said that we are behind and we support and we are in favor of the position of the state. If you want, he made it very clear when you talk about the 29, 23, 21, whatever the lines that they talk about the MBL maritime border line. We do not recognize all of this as a resistance. The thing is that the Lebanese official state has taken a position and Hezbollah supports the state position. Those who are opposing or those who say that Lebanon neglected its own rights, they should bring the alternative. I mean, you know, people make a lot of theories, but when it comes to the practical line, they would all fail to produce anything.
Well, the success of the maritime border demarcation negotiations, Dr. Moussaoui, opens the door to discussion about possible land border demarcation with the Israeli entity, despite the fact that it's occupying Palestinian land. And the Israelis has many times hinted about this matter, that they want this matter to happen. What is the official stance of Hezbollah on this matter, knowing that a lot of Hezbollah's force are using this pretext of land demarcation to demand the disarmament of the resistance, because they think that once the demarcation is done, there's no need for the arms.
It's not the matter of demarcation. It's not about demarcation. Hezbollah has never said that when the demarcation takes place, we're going to do this. There is a percept of a threat. The Israelis continue to violate our rights. They continue to violate our space. They continue to violate our land. We're talking about occupation. We have to remember always that the Israelis continue to occupy Shib'a farms and the hills of Kafar Shuba and other Lebanese villages. They continue to represent a threat to Lebanon on many different levels. That's why when we talk about the capability of Lebanon to defend itself, when we have a strong army that is empowered, that the Americans do not put a veto to arm it with enough and efficient equipments, military equipments, to stand for the Israeli threat, then the discussion could be started about it. So it's not only a matter of demarcation, the land demarcation. It's a matter of percept of threat. It's a matter of liberation of the occupied territories. And when we reach there, this would be another thing to be talked about.
Well, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament at the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
And for explaining how this new success of negotiations has been historic for both sides, but at the same time that the resistance will remain cautious to whatever its enemy is hiding. I want to thank you for your time. Now, please stay tuned, because next we have Sana'a preparing for confrontation in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Despite Sana'a's adherence to the issue of disbursing the salaries of all employees as a prelude to renewing the truce, the core of the rams between it and Riyadh may go beyond that stumbling block to the gains that the two sides can generally achieve. In light of the situation, the United Nations unsurprisingly leaned last week to the Saudi side by holding Ansarullah responsible for thwarting the agreement to extend the ceasefire. The latter continues to confirm and affirm its readiness for all scenarios, including targeting Saudi oil industries, amid indications that this gray period will not be for a long time before its outcomes become clear. Sana'a prepares for confrontation in this following report.
After it has been 6 years since the transfer of the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, watching the suffering of government employees in Yemen without lifting a finger and even with a recommendation to continue using this pressuring card in the face of Ansarullah, the United States suddenly became concerned for the payment of salaries owed to these employees. However, the changing international circumstances, which forced Washington to bow its head to the Yemeni storm without abandoning until now, along with its Saudi pawns, their attempts to circumvent the required understandings to attain a real peace treaty. While Sana'a is aware of the criticality of the American position, it wants to invest it to the fullest extent in achieving these demands related to lifting the siege, on top of which is the payment of pensions regarding which Ansarullah insisted upon. This was evident after Ansarullah sensed an effort to terminate the agreement in this regard. As a result, negotiations to extend the armistice failed, a failure that quickly necessitated mediations in which various parties, including Oman and Qatar, were involved in order to save the situation and prevent the collapse of a truce that the concerned parties seemed to have a great interest in achieving, led by Washington, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and even Doha. In light of these developments, the United Nations leaned last week to the Saudi side by holding Ansarullah responsible for thwarting the agreement to extend the ceasefire. The latter continues to confirm its readiness for all scenarios, including targeting the Saudi oil industries, amid indications that this gray period will not last before its consequences become clear. Day after day, the chances of saving the truce in Yemen are dwindling amid increasing signs of a possible return to fighting. While the current state of truce and non-war between the expiration of the ceasefire period and a final decision regarding its renewal or the resumption of fighting is not likely to be prolonged. The issue of government employee salaries, which represented a major stumbling block to the extension of negotiations, may not in itself remain a reason for dropping the truce and its benefits. While Sana'a is ready for all scenarios, the other side, represented by the Presidential Council residing in Riyadh, continues to refuse to respond to an amended initiative proposed by the UN envoy to Yemen, Hans Grundberg, which includes agreeing to pay the salaries of military employees from the Ministries of Defense and Interior in areas under the control of Sana'a. The Presidential Council rejected the new UN proposals at the behest of Saudi Arabia, only agreeing to pay the salaries of government employees working in the civil sector exclusively from the resources of the Hodeidah port only, while describing those working in Yemeni government-controlled areas as Houthi fighters. However, Sana'a made it clear that refusing to disperse the salaries of 653,000 Yemeni government employees would mean the inevitable continuation of the war.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Dr. Jay Therapel, researcher, academic, and political commentator. Jay, thank you very much for being with us. But before we begin, I really would like to congratulate you, dear Jay, on achieving your PhD. I have followed your hard work throughout the years, and now all the hardships has paid well. You have left no stone unturned, Jay, throughout these years, and I want you to know that I'm extremely proud of your achievements.
Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. Yes, it has been difficult, but I got through it.
Oh, congratulations to you again. Well, Jay, it seems that we are at a nail-biting phase in Yemen. Do you think that Ansarullah will have to implement its threats against the oil refineries for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to make them agree on a new ceasefire?
The short answer is yes. The only way the Yemeni national resistance led by Ansarullah can force the Saudis to pay a price for imposing a siege on Yemen and for stealing Yemen's energy resources is by resuming its drone and ballistic missile operations that target the oil infrastructure of Saudi Arabia. But if those threats are implemented, then Saudi retaliation could actually increase the suffering of the Yemeni people. So we have to acknowledge that during this latest ceasefire from April to October, even though the Saudis only slightly relaxed the blockade, this did offer some relief for the Yemeni people. So according to the United Nations, civilian deaths fell by about 60% during this period, and Yemen was able to replenish its stocks of fuel. That being said, even though the Yemeni people have experienced some temporary relief over the course of the ceasefire, they're still under a siege by the Saudi-led coalition, and both the Saudis and the Emiratis continue to plunder Yemen's energy resources. So far, around $13 billion worth of Yemeni oil and gas has been exported from Yemen, according to Abdul Malik al-Ajri, who is on the negotiating team of the National Salvation Government in Sana'a. I raise this because the Yemeni resistance doesn't need to target oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia. Instead, it can choose to begin its escalation by targeting the theft of Yemen's own resources. Indeed, just last week, the government of the National Resistance in Sana'a, they issued an ultimatum against foreign companies that are involved in buying stolen oil from Yemen that they will be targeted by the aerial capabilities of the resistance.
But Jay, we did hear the Presidential Council, which is basically being played by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, they rejected the new international proposals, which were brought in by the UN, which say that they have to pay for the 653,000 employees residing in Sana'a and the northern part of Yemen. But they still refuse. How do you think Ansarullah will solve this issue?
I'd like to talk a little bit about this. I mean, the stance of the Ansarullah-backed National Salvation Government in the capital, Sana'a, is that the so-called Presidential Council, and I say so-called, is that this council is ultimately responsible for paying the wages of Yemen's government employees because they have the means to do so. So according to Abdul Malik al-Ajri, who's from the negotiating delegation, as I mentioned before, the Saudi-led coalition, they control 80% of Yemen's oil and gas resources. So before the war began, these revenues were used by used to pay the employees who work in Yemen. And Yemen state employees, they comprise about 34% of the total workforce. That's according to another National Salvation Government official, Salim Mughallis. So also the so-called Saudi-backed Presidential Council, they have control over Yemen's central bank reserves, which were transferred to Aden back in 2016 under the former puppet president of Yemen, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, who's based in Saudi Arabia, which is why I call him a puppet. So before 2016, government wages were paid from this central bank, but the National Salvation Government in Sana'a does not have those funds. These are entirely located in Saudi Arabia these days. So crude oil sales from Yemen are around $300 million per month. This does not go to 80% of Yemen's population who live under the National Salvation Government. And that's more than enough to cover the salaries of state employees all across Yemen. But the problem is that according to Ahmed Hajar, the deputy finance minister of the National Salvation Government, most of this is plundered and it's transferred to Saudi Arabia. So the pro-Saudi media has been claiming that the Ansarullah-backed government in the capital Sana'a is refusing to pay the salaries of state employees and instead spending that money on resisting Saudi aggression. So the strategy of the Saudi-backed puppet government is very clear and obvious.